Pavel Pavlovich is a 26-year-old radical revolutionary who is steeled by having seen and experienced both the injustice that exists in pre-revolutionary Russia right around the turn of the 20th century. Lara is 17 years old, striking but demure. And early in the film adaptation of Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak, as Russia is being torn apart from the inside, Pavel and Lara are being brought together in marriage. They are engaged. Now, for complicated reasons, Lara is under the watchful care of an older, uncle-like figure named Dr. Komarovsky. He happens to be in relationship with Lara's widowed mother. And at one scene early in the film, Lara invites her fiancé, Pavel, to meet Dr. Komarovsky to receive his guidance, but probably more so to seek his acceptance and his approval. They meet, and you might say that the two men don't exactly hit it off. The older, wiser Komarovsky begins to ask questions of this young man. What are his plans for taking care of his new wife? What are his plans? And eventually he begins to call into question the entire wisdom of the marriage. And as you might expect, the young man's starting to rear up. He's starting to try to defend himself and his actions. And then in that moment, Komarovsky asks him a question. He says, "I hope you will not take offense, but it would seem to me that you are very young." To which Pavel replies, "I hope you will not take offense by this question, but does one improve with age?" With his eyes practically closed, Komarovsky seethes with these words, "Yes, they become a little more tolerant." And the young man answers back almost as combatively and says, "Yes, tolerant, because one has to become more tolerant of what is one in oneself." There may not be anything thicker in that moment in the tension than the cynicism that is in play there. The old man looks at the young man, and despite all of his ostensible fearfulness and radicalness and courage, all he sees is an impertinence and a foolishness. And the young man looks at the old man, and despite his claim to wisdom of being a font of wisdom, all he is a morally compromised figure. They try to see behind the exterior to find the real truth about them. That's cynicism. That's a film scene, and it took place a while back. The brothers and sisters, I think you'd agree that cynicism is pretty much the air we breathe these days. There is a tendency in us, for reasons good or ill, where we think it's our duty to find out and unmask the half-truth behind the claimed truth, and to think very little of whatever might come. Now, look, we have good reasons for that sort of bent. We're in a political season. All sorts of promises are being made, very few of which will ever be delivered. Open the paper today, and there is innumerable tragedies, all of which may speak to a question about whether justice will ever surface and where it will ever endure. Anybody in this room, you might be facing any number of challenges that are hanging on for so long that you wonder, will there ever be a hope for improvement? I dare say you can become cynical in the midst of and as a result of the season that we're in of Advent. So much pain, so much injustice, so much estrangement in the air while we're singing carols of Silent Nights and Joy to the World. You don't even have to be embittered, though, to be cynical. You can be a functional cynic. I wonder how many of us, if Jesus were never even mentioned in the next 4 weeks, if we never even cast our attention upon the fact that he came to earth, would we have the same mirthful, merry experience in the next 4 weeks than if we had heard his name? If you could have the same experience, then you're functionally a cynic because now Christ is no longer necessary to your Christmas. What to do, what to do. Today marks the beginning of the season of Advent where we remember that Jesus came to earth, but it's more than just a season. It's a time where we seek to cultivate in our souls an anticipation, an expectation, just as those in the Gospels had learned to live with expectation of Jesus' first appearance. And I'm going to argue that the opposite of the cynical life is the life of expectation, the Advent-shaped life. And so for the next several Sundays, we're going to try to ask and answer the question, why did Jesus come to earth? Not to populate your mind with new reasons and explanations for that purpose, but to cultivate within you a life of expectation so that the season might be more than just a segment of time, but an actual preparation for what's ahead, beyond Christmas, beyond New Year, into the rest of your existence. This morning, we're going to look at a moment not early in the life of Jesus' sojourn, but much later, in a moment that teems with cynicism, and all from the mouth of one figure, Pontius Pilate, who famously and cynically asked, "What is truth?" Jesus is going to subtly confront his cynicism, and in the process, I think he's going to confront all the ways in which cynicism creeps into our lives. And you might be surprised to discover how it does. Jesus is going to do that in three ways: by speaking the truth about his identity, the truth about his integrity, and the truth about intimacy with him. So, would you stand for reading from God's word from John chapter 18? Then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. So Pilate went outside to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered him, "If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves, judge him by your own law." The Jews said to him, "It's not lawful for us to put anyone to death." This was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world." And then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." And Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. The moments leading up to this moment happen so quickly, and Jesus speaks in such spare and idiomatic phrases that you can barely make heads or tails of where he's going and what he's intending. But one thing's for sure, the arrest of Jesus at one level is really a case for cynicism. Judas has sold him out. The religious establishment, those that are most knowledgeable in the law and who would have been best positioned to recognize him as Messiah, they're the ones that are hell-bent on silencing him. And Peter, his most trusted advocate, turns on him. If you're looking for reasons to justify cynicism, just look at Jesus' experience. Pontius Pilate, with superb succinctness, summarizes the case in that famous comment, "What is truth? What good is truth?" But it's an interesting thing to note that of the officials whom Jesus is traipsed before during his arrest and show trial, it's Pilate with whom Jesus has the lengthiest and deepest exchange. What do we make of that? It's during that exchange that Jesus is going to subtly confront Pilate and his cynicism, and I dare say he will confront ours too. Firstly, by telling the truth about his own identity. What do I mean? There is an irony who bring Jesus to Pilate. There's an irony among them. At the same time that these Jewish authorities are trying to stack the deck against Jesus and skew the truth in order to trump up the charges, they're actually worried about infringing upon the truth about the law, about whether they should ever be defiled by coming into the presence of a Gentile close to the Passover. They egregiously suppress some truth while they fastidiously seek to comply with some other truth. You ever seen that happen? You ever do that? Probably more often than you'd like to admit. Even the authorities are recognizing the flimsiness of their case against him because they won't even specify to Pilate why they brought him, other than saying, he must be a criminal. Why else would we have woken you up? Pilate sniffs out the dissembling, dispenses with the diplomacy, hauls Jesus into the headquarters, and cuts the chase, asking, look, are you the king of the Jews? Now, there's probably some curiosity in his question, but it's more of the wry kind, because he's a cynic. But Jesus doesn't let the comment just lie there. He confronts it subtly by responding to a question with a question. In so many words, he asks, did you come up with that yourself? Or are you going off just what's been told about me? If it's the latter, then Pilate has bit on the misleading idea that Jesus is here to usurp political power from both the Jewish nation and the Roman state. But if he's just curious, if he's just curious that Jesus may in fact have some kind of authority, then Jesus wants to fill him in on the full story. See, Jesus is not out to make conversation. Now is not the time. He means to speak very clearly about this allegation that he's a king. And he knows Pilate's mind before Pilate knows it himself. But in the question, he's asking the governor to set aside his cynicism for a moment and consider that appearances may belie reality. He's asking Pilate to be cynical about his cynicism. And Jesus does the same to us. Now, Pilate does not exactly fall to his knees in submission. In fact, he probably could not care less. But he's at least interested enough to ask Jesus the bewildering question. If you're a king, why are your own people, in fact, the own brain trust of your own religious organization, why are they hauling you in as if you're a terrorist? And so Jesus explains the reasons for the incongruity, why the moment doesn't fit who he is. And he says in verse 36, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews, but my kingdom is not from this world. And in that he's saying two things. Yes, I am a king. He has real authority and he's worthy of genuine submission. But no, the kind of king he is and the kind of kingdom he rules is different in almost every way possible from what is conventionally known about rule and power. How so? For one, his authority doesn't rest on an assertion, and it doesn't derive from the consent of the governed. His authority originates from something no less than God the Father himself who sent him. Secondly, his priority is different from all the kings and kingdoms of the earth. He's not come to haphazardly replace one of many kings with himself for the sake of change itself or just for the sake of ruling. Jesus doesn't have a stupid grin on his face because he's excited about being in charge. He's come to make a new people by changing them from the inside out, who willingly and not slavishly follow him as a king. And thirdly, but when it comes to the manner of him establishing his rule, it couldn't be more different from how the kings and the presidents and prime ministers of this earth do it. He has come not to conquer with power, but to be conquered himself and to make sacrifice, not the will to power, his preferred mode of exercising power. I am a king, Pilate, he says, but not like the kinds you know. And so he subtly confronts Pilate's cynicism about whether there is a truth, whether there is any authority, and whether any authority can be trusted. Now, how does that confront our cynicism? Jesus is obviously making a claim about authority. And though he says his authority is different from the kings and presidents and prime ministers of this earth, he's not calling us to a lesser allegiance, but a greater allegiance to him. I doubt anybody in this room that would call themselves a Christian would ever explicitly say that they cynically deny the authority of Jesus as a king. But as I said earlier, you can still operate with a functional cynicism in a number of ways. Publicly voicing allegiance to his authority, but silently dismissing the reality of it. That cynicism because it's treating the kingly authority of Christ as if it were a sham. Where does that happen? In a dispute, in a rumble, in a fracas. In that moment that you might be in, do you pause to consider the mind of Christ? Do you pause to ask for his insight and his humility before you launch forth trying to bring clarity or justice to an issue? Is that your instinct? Because if Jesus is king, then his insight and his input has a place in your reconciliation. What about it if you're in a pinch, if circumstances are hard and unremitting? In that moment, do you rear up, guns blazing, arms flying, getting angry, or do you cower in a corner in the fetal position in a panic? If Jesus is a king, then his authority serves either to cool your jets or calm your soul. In your dreams or plans for life, does his kingly authority shape both your objectives and the means by which you're going to accomplish those objectives? How you respond to those moments will reveal the degree of cynicism that you have towards Jesus' kingly authority. Pilate looked cynically upon it, and Jesus answered it. And Jesus answers it in us too. Now look, anybody can claim to be a king. The guy that shot out a window at the White House last week claimed that he was the modern apparition or the modern incarnation of Jesus Christ himself. And he even made a video and he sends it to Oprah to get on her show so that he could convince the world he is Jesus. Now, why he needed Oprah's help, I don't know. Anybody can claim to be king. And part of our cynicism derives from the fact that there's a lot of people making truth claims that just are not trustworthy. So why don't we just fall back into that mode of cynicism when somebody claims to be a king, even like what Jesus said? Here's the second way Jesus then confronts our cynicism, when he tells us the truth about his integrity. You can tell from Pilate's language that he's pretty exasperated with this whole moment. It's just sort of an intra-tribal dispute as far as he's concerned, but he's at least interested enough because he realizes that the issue of Jesus' authority may in fact have to do a lot more with politics and not just Jewish politics. And so when Jesus says, "Yeah, I'm a king," Pilate presses him on it. "So, you are a king?" And Jesus, without flourish, without long speeches, and with no recrimination towards his captor, explains his purpose for coming as a king. He says he came to rule and to exercise that rule in large part by testifying to what is true. Not to establish a rule, enslave subjects, and live off their labor. Not to create a nation and then expand it for the sake of expanding it and not letting naked ambition drive an imperialistic crusade that's only interested in territory and votes. Jesus came to exercise rule by testifying to the truth. Now, what truth? Which truths? If we wanted to catalog it, it would take all day. But there's at least two ideas that Jesus wants to cement in our minds in this moment. One, that his purpose wasn't something that just sort of came over him, that he just sort of discovered, that he found out on a spiritual gifts test. That his purpose was preordained long before he even walked the earth. We get that from the way he characterizes the reasons he came to the earth, why he was born. It's because he understands himself as one who exists not merely as the result of a conception, but as one who's been dispatched by no less than God the Father himself. That's the first truth to which he testifies, and the second is also tangential to his identity. To testify to the truth doesn't mean that Jesus is just sharing bare facts and giving little lectures about God and man and grace and sin and faith and all that good stuff. When Jesus speaks of bearing witness, it's more than disclosing facts. It's disclosing God himself. And when he's disclosing God, it's not just in the form of words. It's in disclosing his own self. He's disclosing the truth because he himself is the truth. "I am the way and the truth and the life," Jesus says. And so as one commentator puts it, when Jesus speaks of testifying the truth, he means in part that he is the fulfillment of what's been anticipated. There's a lot of work to be done on the earth. He knows that. but Jesus is the culmination of God's plan to reconcile the world to himself. He is truth with a capital T. He came to rule by testifying to the truth. And that might sound like a real esoteric and insignificant point. But brothers and sisters and friends, how many examples can we find in the paper alone today of those with power and authority exercising that power to preserve that power by concealing the truth? Why in recent weeks do we discover how universities whose stated mission is to disseminate the truth end up concealing the truth? Why? To preserve their power. But let's get personal. Why are you and I tempted to lie? Because we want to perpetuate a fraudulent perception of ourselves, because we want to control the message, because we want to control the power. That Jesus came to tell the truth is in fact significant in light of how easy and how pervasive it is for individuals and institutions to exercise their power, to preserve their power by concealing the truth. The sacrifice of integrity becomes the seedbed for cynicism. But what's most compelling about Jesus' truth-telling is that he was going to get killed for it, and Pilate knew it. And he told it anyway. He did not refrain from representing the truth, but then he also entrusted himself to his God who sent him to tell the truth by refusing to lash out at those who would suppress it. When you and I conceal the truth, when we skew it for our own purposes, and when our defense of the truth turns more into to a defense of ourselves rather than the truth, we're being cynics because we're setting something above the truth. We're thinking the truth is more of a sham. It's in that moment we really can't handle the truth. But Jesus confronts our cynicism about it by calling us to entrust ourselves to his care, because he's the truth, and then tell him the truth no matter what the cost or the risk. And that leads me to my last point. We've said that he confronts our cynicism with his identity and also by telling us the truth about his integrity. But he always confronts our cynicism in the context of intimacy. What do I mean? The last verse of this passage may seem like an afterthought, but when Jesus says, "Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." When he says that, he's getting at the nature of the truth he brings itself. The choice of phrase is not arbitrary there. He's saying that one doesn't merely know the truth or have the truth. They are of the truth. They're so familiar with it. They're so reflective of it, all because they've been moved by it and shaped by it. To know the truth in the way Jesus understands it is to almost belong to it, as if to be from the truth, as if like you're from Oak Cliff or from Cleveland. You know the place. And people go, "Yeah, I get it. I know, I can see where you're from. You're from the truth." The truth to which Jesus testifies is different from the truth about multiplication tables. They're both truth. 8 times 7 is an immutable truth. It's 56, if you were sure. That Jesus came to earth in human form to reconcile men to God is an immutable truth, but it's different in this way. It requires a different kind of engagement. There's something different, in a sense, behind what's 8 times 7 and what's behind the truth that God came near. And what's different is the voice of Jesus himself. That there's a communion that exists in knowing his truth, in which you don't just comprehend ideas he's expressed, but you're moved by them. You're compelled to act on them because they're from him. He came as a king to testify to the truth so that you and I would come to love both him and the truth he brings. What does that imply? That there's an intimacy that exists between those who hear him and him who speaks. Now, how does that confront, however cynicism might creep into our lives? I would argue that deep down in the recesses of your heart, wherever cynicism may lie, there is a pain that you have sought to cover over. Appearances gave way to realities, and you were left nursing wounds of disappointment or sorrow or tragedy, whatever it might have been, and cynicism has become your chosen way to avoid the pain of disappointment that comes from seeing the true nature of what you thought you knew. Jesus seeks to confront Pilate's cynicism with a few words. But the only thing that would really ever displace that degree of cynicism, the only thing that would ever displace the kind of cynicism that creeps into our souls, is what he did after the encounter with Pilate. For him to become the king he would be, for him to fulfill the truth he came to testify to, and for him to make that truth so penetrating to us, he would have to die. And he would have to die for us, so that what separated us from God would be removed, and so that we could live not with cynicism, but with expectation and confidence that God is for us. That confidence comes through a communion with him that only he can establish and nurture in us. That intimacy doesn't inoculate us from pain, it doesn't insulate us from tragedy, but it does allow us to hope and trust and love even when our experience might tempt us to cynicism. Only the gospel will ever dislodge cynicism in our soul. And so, I come full circle and return to the question that we asked at the beginning. What good is Advent? What's it for? What are we to observe? How are we to be changed? How is it meant to shape us so that we have an Advent-shaped life? Let me put it a little bit cryptically on the front end. I think Jesus' encounter with Pilate asks you to adjust your liturgy. What? I'm not talking about adjusting the way we do the liturgy, the form of worship, the structure and the order of worship on a Sunday morning. I think I'm talking about changing the liturgy of your life. The patterns that you follow in order to know and love the Lord. There's a book called Desiring the Kingdom, and its author, James Smith, argues that people are beings who are not primarily those who think, though think we do, for sure. Instead, he argues that we are fundamentally people who desire, who do what we love. It's why you hear so much about the Reformed tradition talking about affections, those most deeply held and deeply felt beliefs that compel all our actions. We are people whose loves reveal what our true thoughts and beliefs are. And therefore, Smith argues that true education and true change is always geared to more than just informing the mind, but shaping the heart. It means not just filling the head with information, but seeking to cultivate new dispositions in the soul. How in the world do you do that? He says it has in large part to do with liturgy. What does he mean? You and I, he argues, whenever we go to a mall or a movie or a football game, we are part of a set of experiences and patterns that are equivalent to a liturgy. In all of those settings, the people that run them pull out all the stops to send you messages and reinforce them in ways that tweak your emotions so that you really believe it. That's a liturgy. And it shapes you. Through reinforcement in all the ways you can imagine and a lot that you couldn't. And therefore, the implication of that reality in modern existence is this. If what we end up loving and really believing is the result of repeated reinforcement of messages through something like a liturgy, then why wouldn't we invite God to shape our hearts by submitting to a whole liturgy of life? How do you do that? If you read Eric Metaxas' biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you will find early in the book that Bonhoeffer sought to train his pastoral students not simply by inviting them into theological education, but inviting them into a liturgy of life, of taking what they did on a Sunday morning worship and integrating it into every day but Sunday. A liturgy of life that shapes the way we face our days. So that rather than the first thing that you do every morning and check your email or the weather or what Wolf Blitzer might be saying, that the first word you hear is from the Word of God Himself. And that the last word you hear or consider is from the Word of God Himself when you retire at night. What if that became your liturgy? What if the confession of sin was something you did not just on a Sunday, but every day with somebody you trusted and somebody you loved? I'm going to confess to my wife tonight for being so crabby all week for writing this sermon. I want to live a different liturgy. Because otherwise Advent, or rather the Christmas season, is going to shape you, but it won't change you. Not more like the image of the Lord Himself. The bulletin in your hand is a service for today, but what if it became an order of service for all your days? Not just reciting what you find in here, although you could do worse, but allowing its basic framework to guide how you face your day. None of those things require hours, but all of them help shape the dispositions of soul that puts cynicism aside. Because no one became cynical overnight, only over time. And so if cynicism is bred through a kind of repeated ritual-like encounter, then might not the crumbling of our cynicism occur in a way similar to how it became part of us? If Jesus is in fact a king who came to testify to the truth and to make that truth penetrating to us, then might replacing cynicism with a life of expectation occur over time and through a kind of repeated reinforcement, through a kind of liturgy of life? And so we're going to close this way, taking one more piece of liturgical advice from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. On the first day of Advent in every school year, he would insist that those he was training for pastoral education would sing carols lustily, because he knew they were more than minds and theology was more than abstractions. And because he also knew what Augustine said, to sing is to pray twice. What we're going to do is pray twice. And in that context of prayer, both now and for the rest of your days, God may do more to disentangle you from a cynicism than you ever imagined. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.